Greetings, Nerdist Podcast listeners. My molecules are in an excited state. This is a very special episode of the Nerdist Podcast. But first, some quick announcements. Number one, we will be doing a Nerdist Podcast live episode December 15th at Meltdown Comics in Los Angeles. It'll be a slightly different format. Comedians You Should Know. It is an all stand-up show featuring my friends like Matt Bronger, Kyle Kinane, Natasha Leggero. It's going to be super fun. Details are at Nerdist.com. Also, the Nerdist Podcast t-shirt is finally here. Just in time for Christmas, conveniently. You can see all the details on that on Nerdist.com as well. Okay, now this episode. I have to extend a billion thank yous to Devin Johnson from the BBC who made this possible. He's been amazing. Months ago, he said he would get Matt on the podcast, and he did. Devin, thank you so many times. I feel like I'm accepting an award, and that trophy is in the shape of Matt Smith. I also want to thank Matt Stein from the BBC, who helped us navigate the day and who was super awesome. And I also want to remind you that the Doctor Who Christmas special is December 25th at 9 p.m. Eastern on BBC America. And now episode 46 with the delightful, the charming, the Doctor, Matt Smith.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
One of them did Party of Five. The other one did Mallrats.
Oh.
I've turned the recorder on because sure. Matthew and Janet are debating whether or not the London Hotel is owned by actor Jason London.
Or Jeremy London.
I maintain that it could only be Jason.
There we go.
We're just waiting here now.
Okay, everyone. We're waiting.
You know, a lot of people say that's the hardest part.
I think just Tom Petty said that.
There's no way he wasn't quoting Life.
As many of his songs did.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hey guys.
Hi.
Welcome.
Wow, look, it's like a proper
It
radio.
Is, well, don't.
Feels like it.
Please don't
be
a radio
show. But it's definitely not.
Nice to meet you, Chris.
Pleasure to meet you.
Thank
Chris.
You for coming.
Hey, Matt, Janet.
Pleasure
nice
to meet you,
Matt.
Meet
you.
Matt.
Awesome.
Hi, Matt. Pleasure to meet you. This is my first ever podcast.
What?
Oh, welcome.
Yeah. That's fantastic. Welcome to the digital era of media.
Indeed.
I always think of Ricky Gervais.
Yes.
As we all do.
Yes,
he does
as we all do.
Podcasts, yeah. Right?
Nobody does it like Rick.
He did.
The Podfather, as he's referred to
he blew it up.
As.
That's Adam Curry.
Yeah, that's not bad.
He, Ricky, like his podcast was so successful, and then he was like, I didn't make a dime off of this. And then so they turned it into a television show, and then they.
Did he make no money off them?
Originally, no, but didn't they sell? Didn't
yeah,
they bring
it? Was just the fourth episode was him and Stephen Merchant complaining about if they had just charged a pound for each one. It would have millions.
Here's something that
more.
Is,
you know what I'm saying?
This is only something that I no other people agree with me on this. You when you just said Ricky alone, it suddenly you know when there's a person that you think of and their name is just one long name,
mm-hmm. like
you
Tom Hanks.
Separate exactly.
Right.
Suddenly, for the first time ever, I thought his name is Ricky.
Yeah, I never thought of him that way.
Yeah,
never thought of him that way too.
Now, but
Ricky Gervais.
It's Ricky Gervais.
It's true.
It's not
right?
Ricky.
Yeah,
it's Ricky Gervais.
I just
that's an interesting observation.
Don't you think there are just some people whose name you're always string together?
I think even Rita Wilson says, "Hey, Tom Hanks, when you go to the store, can you pick up some Cheerios?"
Rita Wilson's another one.
Yeah, that's true. You're right.
Rita. Her Wilson. Name's Rita. No, you think Rita Moreno when you think the
right.
name Rita.
Matt Smith, welcome to our wee little podcast.
Hey,
it's so nice of you to do this.
It's a complete pleasure. It's a podcast. My first one.
It is your first podcast.
This is great.
So hopefully this will start you in the dark descent of the podcasting world,
and we can sell it for a pound.
Yes. Well, because no one, you know, I mean, the podcasting, it's still, I still almost feel ashamed to say, like, will you be on my podcast? Because it sounds like you're saying, like, my mom will pick us up and we'll do it in the basement and
no,
I've got
I was
an Atari.
Really impressed. Look, you've got, like, full on old school 50s mics.
Yes. Yeah. We've got swanky mics and
if
mic
it makes
stands.
You feel better to do this as though you're
to stick your finger
your
in your
pitch,
ear.
So
right, okay,
you
nice.
Can do yourself better, feel free.
Okay,
as
cool,
in the
cool.
1940s.
Yeah, sure.
So we have a little bit of time with you and first of all, fantastic job.
Thanks, because you're a big Who fan, aren't
I'm
you?
A huge Who fan.
Yeah.
All of us are.
So it's always quite nerve-wracking when you meet big Who fans because, you know, either they're going to go, well done.
Right. or they're
and what they're actually doing is going, well done. See, my gags are my physical gags are wasted on a podcast.
Right. He made a stabbing motion as though he were stabbing Chris.
We should do like a radio play.
Yeah,
stabbing
motion.
And then some a Foley artist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, look, we've got like tin things and stuff.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous room.
Will happen.
You might. I'm sure. How quickly did it? How long did it take before people came up like the hardcore Who fans and said things like? Now, in the end of time, you pulled your sonic screwdriver out, but in the next scene, it wasn't like are people asking you like continuity questions.
I know. I mean, here's like my one rule is stay off the internet.
That's not a bad rule.
Don't go near the internet because my heart's frankly too sensitive and supple to cope. I think generally people have been really quite responsive and quite kind and quite open actually, So, I mean, the continuity stuff is interesting and they pick up on the weirdest stuff. In fact, right, oh God, I'm about to do something really ghastly now, but in episode one, the 11th hour, I'd be interested to see who's picked up on this. This is a continuity exclusive. I'm wearing two jackets, basically. I'm not, but there's a scene at the end of the episode, I think, where I'm plinking and plonking on all the TARDIS equipment. I'm going, tack, tack, ding, dung. And, you know, the TARDIS is about to fly off and the music's rising. And they've got a different jacket to the one I'm wearing in the episode on. Because I wore two. One was stolen by the angels. And it's a different one.
Oh, you've just ruined the entire series.
I know, right?
How can we possibly...
Now, what is a TARDIS? Can you imagine if you had me on? We wanted to have someone on who would make everyone look stupid.
How about this? Even better, there are probably forums who are like... That think that the jacket represents some sort of cross-dimensional thing. Like, they've created a whole story around the separate jacket.
About what it means, because it's a different doctor coming in from a different time in a different jacket, which it sort of could be, couldn't it?
But I almost feel like this is the type of show where Stephen Moffat would go back and justify that somehow.
Totally. Like, but now it really irritates him because I told him he's going to hate me for doing this. Because now you watch it, guys, I can see that and it really irritates
him. Eating away at him.
Yeah.
So were you, I'm sure people have asked you this question a million times, but, you know, did you watch the show growing up? I mean,
Well, it's it's horrible because I feel like I'm churning out the same answer, but it's a true one. I was part of that rather barren age where they took it off the TV, the BBC, stupidly. So I didn't have it on the TV when I was growing up, you know. It was only when Chris Eccleston came back. I mean, I had references of it. It was, you know, repeated on... We've got a channel called UK Gold. It was sort of repeated on that. And I remember, you know, a sort of strange old man. It was William Hartnell, weirdly, running down a corridor. And then I think Pertwee, I've got vague recollections of, and Tom Baker and the scarf and... So because it's embedded in your fabric as a British person somehow. So, you know, I was aware of it, but it wasn't on the TV. And I was robbed of it as a child. I want to be eight and frightened.
Oh, the Tom Baker episodes, because they show them on public television when I was a kid.
Yeah.
They scared the shit out of me. Like,
really?
The music was terrifying.
It was, you know, like a lot of it just looked like this black box theater. And then some creepy person in a mask would come out. And
did, like, you watch it as a kid then?
I watched it a little bit as a kid, but it really did freak me out.
Really?
It really freaked me out when I was a little kid.
I think my experience is similar to yours in that it's all sort of nebulous and kind of in the back thrust
like
of my brain because
like
my parents watched it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I have memories of like kind of sneaking out because I knew they were watching television after I was meant to be in bed, and I would sneak out and sort of creep out and watch it and become terrified and then not be able to reach out to them because I was disobeying by even sneaking out and watching it. So I had to like go back to it and be like, I'm a bad kid and I'm terrified.
Yeah, it's
like
a world of pain,
but I don't remember
it?
Plots or anything like that.
I just remember it being not as funny as Monty Python, which was on right before it.
Yeah.
I remember everything not being as funny as Monty Python.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, the Hartnell episodes, though, a lot of them were destroyed, right? They don't even exist anymore.
Really?
I think it was during a period of time where they... Like, decades ago, they didn't think about reruns. They didn't think of it.
They have audio of them now.
They basically just recorded things on flammable material that demagnetized.
No way.
So I think there are a bunch of episodes that have never been seen since.
Oh, that's such a shame.
When you said destroyed for a second, I was thinking like a Fahrenheit 451 situation.
Yes, the government thought that it was... Yeah.
Yeah.
What sort of comedy influences did you have growing up? Were you more of a comedy person?
Yeah, well, like Peter Sellers is my all-time hero, the Pink Panthers. And in fact, I watched a lot of that stuff before I did Who. Because, you know, what's so incredible about Peter Sellers is when he's playing Clouseau is How familiar are you with them?
Pretty familiar.
You know, so say either, like, you know, the globe or the snooker cues. You know, when he mm-hmm. gets all the snooker cues, he never apologises for his recovery. So he'll do something mental. And then, like, acts like, you know, like, absolutely nothing's happened. And so he is... And then, I don't know, just so much of his stuff is he's a huge influence. Python, of course, and a British show called Some Mothers Do Have 'Em, which is about a guy called Frank Spencer, and again, it's just a sort of wonderfully brilliant comic performance. But I'd say kind of Peter Sellers primarily is someone that I've really consciously looked at and studied, you know.
That's pretty fascinating. I think Peter Sellers would have made a really interesting doctor.
Oh, he'd have been the best.
Yeah.
He'd have been amazing. He'd have been really, truly brilliant, I think.
Because he has a natural coldness about him, too.
Yeah, yeah, totally has a coldness about him. And a real, you know, I think the darkness of Sellers would have been really interesting. As, you know, because that's what interests me about the Doctor, is that actually, look at the blood on the man's hand. 900 years, countless very selfish choices. And he's literally blown planets up, his own race, you know. Mm-hmm. That's all on his hands, which is why I think he has to make silly jokes and wear a fez, because if he didn't, he'd hang himself.
That is the eternal comic struggle. I have to crack jokes so that I don't shoot myself in the face.
Well, that's actually something that I had kind of wanted to ask, was the idea of, you know, obviously if you get a movie role where it's sort of cut and dry in that, you know, listen, this takes place in the 1950s. He's an opium addict. His, you know, you kind of create the backstory of what his parents were like, because that's not in the script.
Yeah.
And do your research, and then we start principal photography and go.
Yeah.
Versus coming into something like this where you've got other actors who have done it, you've got other takes on the same character. How much of that?
Almost 50 years worth of actors who've done it.
How much of watching those performances folds into, you know,
your
work as an actor on the research, or just the kind of backstory or the stuff that's going on in your mind when you're not.
Well, I mean, my choice was that you can't allow any of it to, because it has to be completely singular. And actually, when I auditioned for the part, I hadn't really seen an episode.
That might have actually served you pretty well.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I then went back and watched all of David's stuff and all of Chris's stuff, and then went back and, you know, when it dived in, I mean, I haven't watched everyone, but I've watched a lot, you know. But that was purely choice, because it's like any sort of great, well, to me, it was quite nice because I became a fan. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And then it was quite worrying, because the magnitude of it started to dawn of what it actually was, you know. But it has to be very kind of singular, the Doctor. I think it's sort of like Hamlet on the television. It has to be your interpretation and your way and your madness, you know, because he's mad and in a great way, in a sort of sane way. But it had to be very singular and. You know, and of course there was great contention about my age and things like that, and so I couldn't pay attention to anything else apart from, you know, to my own choices.
Well, I think one of the interesting things, I think you did exactly what you should do with a character like this. First of all, brilliant mechanism on the part of the BBC for, like, well, we can make this show go on forever because we'll just keep casting it over and over again.
It's a great format. It's, you know, and also, you know, brilliant. It's the best TV format I think there is, because you're not bound by logic, time, spatial genre.
Right.
You know, and so it's boundless. It's limitless.
It's the craziest thing. Like, I got it when I watched the Christopher Eccleston episodes, when the first episode takes place in modern day London, and the second episode they're in the year 5 billion.
Yeah,
to blow up, and I'm like, holy shit.
Yeah, I know. I had the same.
Whatever you want to do.
I had the same when I watched. Yeah. I watched the first episode with Christopher Eccleston. I was like, okay.
Yeah.
And I watched the second episode, and I was like, shut the fuck up. Like, I couldn't even wrap my mind around it. I was calling people, like, they're watching the planet. Like, it was
incredible.
It's funny, too, to sort of see what appeals to different types of fans, because with all the ones that we've watched together, he knows that, and we have a dear friend who's a huge, huge fan, who our friends Gabe and Etta, who go to the conventions and are actually some of those brilliant people we know in terms of their minds, but I always am the one that's like, I like when they go back in time and meet historical figures. Like, that's sort of what appeals to me. And when they're really somewhere completely alien that feels sort of cold and empty, I tend to sort of shut off because I go for the sort of emotional stakes.
Do you have a preference between, you know, like interdimensional or planetary or historical?
I know, you know, I kind of love them all, you know, and that's a bland answer, but it's true because, I mean, I think that's the virtue of the show, but it is, there's something wonderful about feeling very close to the concept of time and time travel and the TARDIS and just filming on the TARDIS every day. I mean, that's one of the great virtues of playing this part, is that actually it's me in the whole world that gets to be really close to the notion and go, ah, listen, hey, really hot chick with red hair, come with me, come with me. Why? Just come.
Get in my space van.
Yeah, you know, and you know, it's, you get to just, yeah, I'm very, and it's because it's such a brilliant, romantic, glorious notion, time travel, isn't it? It's such a wonderful thing in concept, and so to be close to it. But I mean, I guess it's a virtue of the show. I like them both because, you know, just practically on a film set, it's, you know, all the futuristic stuff can be really fun and interesting, the crazy monsters, and then you go back and you visit Vincent Van Gogh.
Uh-huh.
And he was, oh man, Tony Karam was the best.
He's a fantastic actor.
We had a wrestle.
In everything.
We had a wrestle. As the Doctor and Vincent, I won. If you ever interview him, you've got to ask him about it. We've been for a few glasses of vino. And Karen was there. This all sounds a bit sordid. It wasn't. It was purely, because he's a kind of a method actor. So he was picking up chairs and stuff, going, just being all Vinny. And we had a wrestle.
Now for a second, I thought, you said method actor. For a second, my brain jumped to, I thought you were saying, he's a meth addict, so he's very hard to take down.
I don't think that's what he was saying.
I don't think that's what he was saying. So when you're on the TARDIS and you're shooting, is it sort of like a standard set where it's like, yeah, some of the levers are held on with duct tape and they're shooting around, so what is the actual set?
It's, why haven't you been to visit?
I just got an invitation second ago.
Yeah, come and visit, man.
I absolutely will.
You really should.
I will fly out there and I will do that, and then I will go on bargain hunt.
Yeah.
Okay, give up bargain hunt, all right? Okay, it's not coming back.
Bargain hunt.
It's a favorite show, Bargain Hunt.
Yeah, absolutely.
The internet.
Is that the one with David Dickinson?
It used to be. It's Tim Wannacott now.
Oh, Wannacott. Show really changed. After they regenerated the host on Bargain Hunt.
Should we ask him about my theory that James Bond is a Time Lord?
Yes, he has a theory that James Bond is a Time Lord.
And like the shows are going to sort of marry up one day.
Well, I just think that the British government has done something to the Time Lord.
Really?
Forget that he's a Time Lord and then just work for the government.
And that explains all the different iterations of James Bond.
That is a lot
it's
of time
kind
on your
wonderful. I love that.
I sadly have.
I love it.
Yeah, it's very interesting. But, you know, kind of for me, this may be a controversial choice and probably quite a self-proclamatory one, but I think the Doctor's cooler than James Bond.
He is.
James Bond.
Well, don't get me wrong, James Bond, you know, hats off, brilliant.
He tipped his imaginary hat.
Yes. But,
it's a podcast.
But, you know, he hasn't got a... He's not a Time Lord.
I would rather have a TARDIS than an Aston Martin.
Hell yes.
I would rather have a sonic screwdriver than cufflinks that can stun a person.
Well,
that's not what I want.
And I, you know...
Sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'd rather be strangely flummoxed by women than
than to just sexually conquer all of them.
Yeah, because the Doctor's just like, what do I do with you? I don't know. You're a woman.
Well, no
but
one
they
is.
They are both holding women at a distance.
It's true.
They're dark souls
because they can't. Well, no one. I mean, anatomically, you know, the Doctor has a binary circulatory, has a binary heart system. We don't know anything about his reproductive system. We have no idea.
No.
What's under there?
Until now, Matt.
Until now.
No pressure.
Yeah. That's a Stephen Moffat question, I think. And he'd give you a really zingy, interesting
answer. I'm sure there would be an answer for that.
You'd like Stephen. He'd like you, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
We were really excited when he sort of became...
We love the best.
He's the best, man. He's the best there is.
We loved his episodes so much.
Yeah, the Moffat episodes during the Tenet years were like, holy shit. These are mind-bending.
And the other stuff he's done. I mean, like the...
Yeah.
And the Jekyll and Hyde thing.
Tintin's just done as well for Spielberg. And
Did I read correctly? You auditioned for Sherlock.
Yeah, I went in and auditioned for Dr. Watson because Benedict had been cast as Sherlock already, and clearly I'm more Sherlock than I am Watson. I think.
Well, the Doctor is space Sherlock. Everyone I think understands that.
And And so, needless to say, I didn't get it. But then, like 2 days later, I got a call saying, "Do you want to audition for The Doctor?" And Doctor Who, I was like, "What?" Really? Yeah. And you know, it was really interesting because I was just like, "Well, I'm never going to get this. Well, what the hell?" Yeah, of course.
It's such a great way to go into something, though. Yeah. Like you said, you sort of didn't feel that weight and the anxiety of it, and got to do your thing.
You know, I just read it and was like, "Whoa, this guy's amazing." You know, it's yeah, yeah. So maybe that heritage wasn't sort of pounding down until I got the job, and then it was.
What was the audition process like? I mean, did they just write a generic scene, or did they give you tenant scenes or new scenes?
Episode one. They gave me episode one and two scenes to learn, but you got it like 2 days before, and you can't tell anyone. And you know, I tell everyone this story, but God bless my mother, because I had a sort of a coloured scarf at university. Anyway, when David announced that he was leaving, she texted me saying, "You should be the next Doctor." Swear to God. And yeah. So then I got the audition and I rang her and she said, "See?" I said, "Well, I haven't got it yet." And she said, "Well, no, you probably won't get it." And I said, "Well, yeah, I probably won't, you know." But I did.
Kudos to your mom. I mean, I get those calls from my mom sometimes where she's like, "You should be on this."
Larry King's leaving.
If you could take over. I'm like, "Mom, it's not, I'm never going to."
You could take over from Larry. Hasn't Piers Morgan taken over?
Piers Morgan's taken over for Larry. Yeah.
When does that start?
January, I think.
I saw him last night with Rumsfeld. I think he was on. Was it last night or someone? No, it wasn't Rumsfeld.
At some point, Larry King goes back to his home planet. He's clearly not human. He's mostly dust on the inside.
He just ties his suspenders to something hard and just launches himself.
That's right. "I have to go back to my home planet now. Here's Piers Morgan." And then he just vanishes. It'll be a fitting end to Larry King.
Indeed.
What was so amazing to me was to see that pretty quickly after you took over the show, I posted this video on my site of you closing Glastonbury with Orbital.
Yeah.
and what was so amazing to me about that, it was just looking at your face and then just sort of seeing, like, you know, a few months ago, this wouldn't have happened. And now here's this guy, and you're soaking in and you see, like, 40,000 people.
I know. Oh, man.
And they
and they're playing the Doctor Who song.
Now, were you playing the keyboard?
Yes.
Should I not tell the people? Yes. The
quotes? No. Oh. No. Yeah. No. Do. Yeah. I was doing quotation marks because I don't know. Yeah, it was itchy or something.
Was it
a player
keyboard, like it a player piano?
But I mean, that it just came about because I met those guys at Coachella, you know, the music festival. Mm-hmm. And they're just massive Doctor Who fans. And they were like, "Whoa, you're Doctor Who." And I was like, "You're the dude from Orbital.
How do you know?"
Yeah, yeah. And they were like, "Yeah, kind of." And I was like, because I have a friend who's really into them. And then, yeah, we just got talking. They were like, we're going to close Glastonbury. Do you want to come on?" But we planned for me to come up on a plinth and come out the TARDIS in full costume. But there was, you know, there's things that, I don't know, with branding issues or something. Sure. I don't know. So you can't. But it was one of those sort of once in a lifetimers.
It was amazing. And I love, like, and that was the other reason that, because I was enjoying your work on the show, and then that's when I kind of felt like, I think I like this guy as a person. Cause
really?
You just seemed so, like, you were so earnest about it. It's like, hello!
Yeah, well, because you... But literally, I didn't want to do it. It took, like, my kind of girlfriend and my best friend to go. Because I was like, it's the last... Everyone's just going to go, "Who the hell is this dude?"
The British audiences can be a little harsh sometimes.
But they
seem to genuinely enjoy that they
kind of went with it, which was great. Yeah, I shall never, ever forget it. It was great.
Have you had other experiences like that where you've sort of been jettisoned so quickly that somebody that you were a fan of
immediately absolutely.
Becomes your fan as well, and you're like, we get to meet each other sort of on this
hello Michael Caine.
Richard Curtis, who I love as a writer, and he came and you know, wrote an episode of Doctor Who, because what's great about Doctor Who is, and I think kind of one of the ways that we get loads of great people in the show, is because they're kids.
Yeah,
they have 10-year-olds and 8-year-olds who are just like, make something I can watch, and you know, it's sort of one of the reasons that we get. And I had a great moment in LA actually. Again, I sound really vain, though. This
No, you absolutely do not.
Please, not
absolutely do not.
Yeah, please, let's talk more about
wonderful moments that happened to me. We asked you.
Oh, everyone.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, so I'm in a hotel. We come over here to promote the show, the first screening, which is, all you know, very nerve-wracking experience because it's, you know, it's the first episode of this thing that we've all been working on so hard, and people were like, who's this young dude, you know? Mm-hmm. But anyway, so I'm in a hotel room and it was a lovely suite that I had and there was these massive curtains. So I'm there and I just sort of went, oh, cool, check it out. And this was, and then on kind of sunset and there was a massive billboard.
Oh, yeah, I know that billboard.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And because it was at the, that hotel on Sunset, what's it called?
Like near the Standard or the...
Yeah, yeah, it's just one up, the Mondrian.
The Mondrian.
Yeah, Mondrian. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and it was outside there and I was like, and I was on the phone to my mum. At the time, I was like, Mum, I'm looking at a billboard of myself. And that was a pretty seismic moment, you know.
And she was like, I told you, you'd have a billboard.
Well, yeah, you know, she was... Yeah,
yeah, those billboards, they, I was so excited to see those billboards because, you know, up until this last season, I feel like the awareness of Doctor Who has been largely word of mouth. And it's just been a lot of people... What? Oh, we've received a message.
Oh, wow, Devin pops up out there.
Being haunted.
That was brilliant. Comic.
We've received a message.
What's going on down there? There's two.
That would scare the shit out of you if in the middle of the night and they can just pop on like that and tell you
that
have a message.
Could have been a message from the future, you guys.
No, it's, I don't think it's.
It's River Song.
Oh wow, she's cool.
Are we now? I know you can't really say anything about what's coming up on the show, but are we going to get a better idea of what her deal is in the next?
Yeah,
in the next cycle.
I think we are. I think it's going to be pretty massive. Oh man,
I know.
It's so tough because I wish I could tell you, like, episodes one and two, the ones that we've come out here to film. Stephen is, I don't know, man. I think it's the best monster since the Weeping Angel. I think actually it's better than the Weeping Angel. It's on par with it. You want to see it. You want to see the thing. It's the most hideous thing in the world. But it's brilliant. It's so clever. And it's part of a really big arc. It's part of a really big story arc, which harks back to season five. But, yeah, you know, the Doctor is, you know, he knows he's someone from her future, but who?
It drives us crazy.
And then
in the best way.
They're breaking up the season into two chunks next year, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because so episode seven will be, as Stephen describes, the mother of all cliffhangers, which I haven't read yet. But I don't know, man. And Amy, there's something going on with Amy, man. It's crazy. There's something going on. It's you know, and it's wonderful. He started like it's what he's done with one and two is very clever. Very brilliant. His mind baffles me constantly.
I bet.
Yeah, because where did you come up with this stuff? You know, like all that time stuff. You know,
it's so intimidating to imagine having to think that way. For me, just creatively, like I would just be terrified.
Yeah, it's a different way to think to cut through time because then you step out of linear storytelling and you have to think of like multidimensional storytelling.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, there's this half human doctor on another dimension, and then there's Matt in the main one, and then there's other people.
Even in the last two, it's like, oh, she has a drink, and then he goes back. And
I know.
Has a drink. It's like
I know.
What? Yeah.
I know. Yeah, yeah. Oh, I'm pleased you like all that stuff because kind of. You know, kind of people worry that, and they're like, oh, but it's too complicated for children and stuff. And I think, no, you know, because it's kind of like The Simpsons.
Absolutely.
You know, kids get it for where they get it, and then other guys get it for, you know, so it can operate on a lot of different levels.
The texture is so important for a great show.
I don't have kids because they're a lot of work, quite frankly.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
But what I think is great about the show is that it is a show that you could watch with your kids or your grandparents, and you can all appreciate something, and then you can all bond about it.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the brilliant things about it is that it is entertaining for adults as well.
Yeah. Oh, well, I mean, I would hope so.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah. Good.
I was reading that you started out as a. You were a football player.
I was, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not America. Yeah. We say I don't know why we call American football football. American football is a dumb name for football here because they don't really use their feet.
A couple times.
But
field goals
it's not
and
like
stuff.
Soccer.
I watched some last night, man. I watched some.
Is it baffling as American? I don't watch American football.
It's kind of baffling. Yeah, I have no idea what's going on. But but you know, there was it was quite yeah yeah. It was I was entertained. Philadelphia. Beat the Washington Redskins, is it?
I don't know.
I think so, yeah, I don't know.
That was a historic game because they scored the most points.
Points, and the quarterback was like amazing, yeah.
Ever.
Yeah, this dude.
In the NFL.
It was like 49 or something.
49 points in the first half.
Yeah, Myra, anyway, I still don't, still not connecting with it. No. So you started off as a footballer?
As a footballer, yeah.
And then
I got injured and had a teacher who encouraged me into acting. He cast me a play and I didn't turn up. I just thought acting was for girls, you know. I played football, man. It was like, little did I know that it's quite the opposite. It introduces you to girls. And I went to university and did a thing called the National Youth Theatre, and then did a couple of plays and stuff and got into it, and that's how it happened for me.
It's funny, what it was funny, like walking through parts of London where they're like, no football jerseys. Like, you're really? Not allowed to wear.
Oh, yeah. Like, if you. If,
because it might
elicit. Yeah, yeah, yeah. If you go to Tottenham, don't wear an Arsenal shirt. Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
That would be bad.
That's intense.
Yeah. Oh, God.
I can
really
understand
intense.
That level of.
Yeah, oh, man. It's. Yeah, God. Or if you go into, like, you know, if you go to Manchester and you go in the wrong part, you can't wear a Man City shirt or a Man United shirt. It's.
I would be killed instantly because I don't know any of those rules. I'd probably accidentally wear the wrong color.
Then you could go, look, man, I'm from the US. I have no idea.
And then they would
kick
the shit out of me twice as hard. So I'm either way, it's not gonna.
That's
not gonna
for getting us into a war based on lies. We're sorry. I'm apologizing now.
Are you pretty much work? Like, what's your shoot schedule for the show? Or do you work
intense.
Nonstop all year?
Yeah. We work. We do what's called 11-day fortnights. So you do 6 days, 5 days, and you do. 7 till 7 every day. If it's not a night shoot, you know, obviously that will be whatever.
Mm-hmm.
12 till 12 or whatever, you know. And and we shoot for 9 months a year. So we finish this series on the 20th of April.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the line learning. Really, that's the really seismic part, because obviously as a doctor you're saying, you know,
this is a blah 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 blah.
The confibulations of the thing of everything, you know, it's mental kind of doctor speak, and so you can't blag that. You have to learn it. And rhythmically, Stephen's very particular, and so it's it is a lot of work. But
do you have tricks? Do you sort of have things that work for you better than others?
Just panic, just blind panic.
Good. Always a good choice.
I gotta learn it. But you know, sometimes if there's loads and I'm struggling, I'll put it on a dictaphone and listen to it and just try and, you know, any way it goes in, really.
Right.
But it does. I've got. Quite good at learning lines.
I always marvel at that. Like when I watch, I loved Sherlock, by the way.
Yeah,
it was
brilliant.
Was so great.
Great, I know, right?
And they did such a great job. But even watching like House, which is sort of the American's tribute to Sherlock,
right?
Well, Hugh Laurie, anyway.
Yeah. But whenever you're a character, whenever he's incredible,
amazing.
So
right?
You can get all the Stephen Fry, Hugh Laurie stuff on Netflix.
Yeah,
too.
Stephen Fry's cool. I met him the other day.
Did you?
Yeah. I was really excited. I was like, wow, you're Stephen Fry.
Yeah.
And, he must have known you.
Yeah. He's a massive Who fan. He's a big Doctor Who fan, man. Yeah, he loves it. But, you know, and we got talking about a writer, that, you know, and he, I don't know. He's everything you'd want him to be. Stephen Fry. Yeah, I know.
I follow him on Twitter. Like, he's fascinating.
Talking about someone about Hugh Laurie yesterday, and I said something about, oh, but you know, and he's British, and of course we all love those amazing British actors. And he was like, well, he's ours now. Like America
has claimed
Hugh Laurie for our own.
Now, that would get your ass kicked in a British drama academy the same way claiming a football team would. Like, we try to claim Hugh Laurie as our own. That wouldn't work out well. But that show is, you know, it's just like, I love seeing strong, intelligent lead characters
instead of
characters that have to
I've never watched House. That's bad, isn't it?
No. It's not.
That's okay. You got plenty.
You seem busy. You seem like you got a lot on your plate.
But
True Blood, I couldn't put down, man.
I watch that too.
Did you not like it?
I did like it.
I love vampires. I've always loved vampires. And I don't know. You know, hats off to you guys over here, the way you make television. It's, you know, they do it very well.
Really? Because I always feel like British television does it better.
Well, really?
I do, because you guys...
Sopranos, The Wire, True
but
Blood,
But we always
House,
talk about how... I think I'm more interested in what the actors are permitted to do and how they don't get pigeonholed the same way as they do in America. I always complain about this to you, because
someone
you can
just
have
said that
Hugh
to me,
Laurie doing House, and I think... it feels like all along the line, getting the Shakespearean training, but also doing a lot of kind of farce stuff. And I just feel like the opportunities, like we sort of look at even like Jane Austen or BBC kind of produced based on a novel from the 1800s or what have you, will have the same cast as, you know, oh my gosh, Emma Thompson and Kenneth Branagh used to do sketch together. Find that so...
I don't know.
I'm so envious of that.
I'm more fascinated by British television because British television will just do 6 episodes of something and then never do it again.
Yeah, they don't waste it. Like I feel like The Office is a great example of a show going on far longer than maybe it should have.
The American Office. Yeah. But I love The American Office. But I watched a bit last night and I'm like, they had a baby? Where does that go?
That's what happens when you have to write so many episodes of television.
And I love The American Office. I think, because I was really worried, because again, I guess as a British person, you go, whoa, that's something that we made, and it's really good, and you got to get that right. But then I think they smashed it. I think Steve Carell is brilliant. I think Dwight's brilliant, you know? And I think it was great. And I actually think the love story in that was really good when he went off and went to the other branch and everything. But then, so I've missed loads, obviously, because they had a... And now it's, obviously, it's like, now I know. So I'm like on episode, on series 3 or whatever.
There's a baby coming, so I think they'll pull through.
With British television, I always feel like as an actor in British television or a host in British television, you never have...
Presenter.
You never have... Thank you. You never have the power that... You know, because you're like, can I get a raise? And they'll go, actually, we'll just recast you. We'll stop doing your series. You're like, oh, I'm sorry.
And I mean, that's the great thing about American television is they reinvest. They give you more money every year, it seems, or so I'm told. Yeah. So if you get a hit, you know, they go True Blood, have another $1 million and make it better.
Yeah, but I think less episodes makes things more precious. Like if you watch any of Chris Morris's stuff, like Day to Day or Brass Eye, or
Brass Eye's great,
any of the Alan Partridge stuff. Like the fact that it didn't.
I'm Alan Partridge, right?
Well, yeah, but
isn't that incredible?
It's incredible. Like the fact that was so genius to me is just how they would just do a new Alan Partridge series and change the surroundings of his life, and then that would be like a couple years later. Like that to me is a gorgeous way to do television.
I love Alan Partridge. I'm pleased you like Alan Partridge.
Love Alan Partridge.
Like just brilliant. Oh man, I could talk about that a lot.
Do you know him?
He's a big. Oh no, but I mean you know that's influences. An influence. Yeah,
Steve Coogan.
Dan. Dan. You can't hear me, Dan. Dan. Oh, and he's so mean to poor old Lynn. He's great. Yeah, I mean, we've got some. I guess we have got some great sort of comic actors.
I bet you could get Steve Coogan on Who.
I don't know, man. He's like gone Hollywood, man. He's in the big movies now.
Really?
What did I see with him? Is he in Iron Man? No, not Iron Man. He plays a really rich dude in something I watched the other day. I don't know what it was.
Maybe I can't remember. I don't know what he was in.
He's so funny in Tropic Thunder, though.
He was incredible in Tropic Thunder.
I mean, that's not the last thing at all, but that's what I think of when I think of him. Really quickly, I'm just, for the nerds out there, of which I'm one, I do want to say, Matt, that, you know, the doctor would have known that there was a baby. He would have just copped back and forth around episodes, and it would have been fine with him because that's the way his life is.
I know.
So I want you to consider giving those earlier episodes a try because
a trousseau.
The doctor has a lot of information, and he still goes through and conducts himself just fine.
Shut up and push up your glasses, nerd.
Yell at Janet.
I have a couple. First of all, when I started blabbing to the internet about how much I love the show. They're the things that get the most responses from people. Like no matter what I talk about, whenever I talk about Who, that's where people respond the most.
Really? That's interesting.
So I sent out a thing last night on Twitter that said, oh, if you have a question for Matt Smith, put it on my website. I'll ask a couple of questions.
Okay, cool.
Not all of them were amazing questions, but there were some good.
The ones
that were interesting. A guy named Red Jay said, did you write fan fiction? Is that true?
Kind of as a way to get into to playing the Doctor, I looked a lot at Albert Einstein because I thought who's closest to this man on the planet, whose brain is, because the Doctor is, and that's the brilliant thing about playing him. In every scene you do, whatever room you walk into, he is head and shoulders the cleverest person in there, which gives you carte blanche to be anything you want. It's like, well, yeah, I am, but I'm cleverer than you, so moving on. And I thought, so Einstein, and so I looked a lot at Einstein, and then I was in Egypt at the time, and as a way, you know, I had lines to learn and stuff, but I thought I didn't want to do that too early, but I wanted to connect with it every day. I wanted to touch base with the doctor, so I wrote about him and Einstein traveling, and they were locked in a time box, a thing, I don't know, it's just this, you know, a thing, a narrative thing in Egypt with all the cleverest people that had ever lived. And so I just wrote short stories every day about those two. But I made Einstein sort of a bumbling womanizer who the doctor loved and was totally endeared to. But like Cleopatra, you'd find him in bed with his trousers around his ankles. And it was at the time that Einstein was developing the bomb.
Uh-huh.
And the doctor's like, look, you know, you can't do this. You can't do it. And it's him trying to dissuade him. And Einstein being like, oh, it's fine.
Why is this not an episode?
I sort of wrote. And maybe I'll publish them one day.
I don't know.
But they're probably really bad. This is the thing. But, you know, they sound good in theory, but the execution's probably pretty pants.
I think it sounds incredible. I think, look, if you just casually slipped it under Moffat's door and didn't put a name on it.
That's not how it works with Moffat.
Does that work?
No.
Hey, Steve, I got an idea.
Yeah. Keep it yourself, Matt. I love my lines. I think.
Can we have dinosaurs on the show?
I've way asked for that. Yeah. I really want dinosaurs, man, that can talk.
Yes.
Talking dinosaurs. Yes. Of course, they're an alien species.
Jurassic Park 4.
Yeah.
Someone by the name of Ood Kiddo wants to know, of course, why not?
Why not, right?
Why not? I like that the Ood get hip.
Yeah.
They get all hip.
They are kind of hip, though.
Hey, like, I got my brain in my, I got my secondary brain in my hand. Yeah. I'm tearing shit up.
Nazi dressers.
How much influence do you have on the scripts?
Very minimal influence, really. Because also they tend to be brilliant. Do you know, he's so brilliant, Stephen, and I wouldn't presume to be able to do. The way he deals with structure and pace is incredible, and obviously he's very open, but I tend not to question the man's authority.
So there's not a lot of improv on the set.
No, there's none. With other writers, there's more. But with Stevens, I say as it is on the page, word for word. Because it's undeniably brilliant, and rhythmically. And also, what's so interesting about coming back, actually, is that he's really writing for me more and more.
Mm-hmm.
And, he's making me funnier, I hope. Because he's, you know, he's playing into my clumsiness as a human more. And it's
what a compliment to have, to start seeing it shaped.
Yeah,
to kind
exactly
of where you, that's great.
It is a compliment, isn't it? Yeah, so no, none really. I am powerless.
Let's see. Here's a question. What is your favorite board game, says Patrick Rose?
Good question. You won't know it. It's a game called Wembley, and it's a football game that I played when I was a kid. And I was very possessive over, sadly. And it's sort of gambling, essentially.
Nice.
Yeah. But at chess, probably, is my favorite.
Chess?
Game.
Chess player?
Yeah, huge chess player.
I used to play competitive chess in grade school.
Did you?
Like, to the point where I can't really play anymore.
It's so annoying, you know, because I think my best friend, Nick, played competitive chess when we were young. And I was just like, you're going to chess club?
Yeah. Yeah,
you're a loser, man. Like chess club, and now he's really good. And it's actually chess is war.
Mm-hmm.
Chess is mind war, and it's I just find it the most brilliant game. I love it.
It was a dark, like, I would sit across from kids, and it was one thing to get picked on by a jock because they would just punch you in the chest.
Yeah,
but to try to be mind. Warped by someone you're sitting across from, by they're trying to get into your head.
Those are the best villains.
Saying
right
nothing.
Yeah.
Just stare. I don't take my eyes off the board, man. I don't. But I take ages. So if I was playing properly, you know all the stuff
with the clock,
I'd be down.
Yeah.
And they think I'm trying to sabotage it, but
so many people are so happy that you just said chess. I mean, really. Yeah.
Oh, chess is the greatest game.
Absolutely.
Someday, maybe we'll sit down and play a game of chess.
Yeah, that would be nice.
I would love
inside
it.
The tortoise.
That would be nice.
Inside the tortoise. On set, on
all right,
visit,
let's not
with the three of us.
Scare him.
It's going to be great.
and then we'll be best friends, and then we'll buy a house in the English countryside.
I gotta go.
And we'll catch up on the office.
Yeah. And then we'll grow turnips. We'll grow turnips, Matt. So someone named Steven wants to know, when is Christopher and His Kind coming to the States? The Isherwood.
It's released in January, and I would hope it would come out. I was asking Devin earlier. I mean, I hope it comes out over here. I would like it to, because I came out to visit Don Bacardi,
mm-hmm.
who is Christopher Isherwood's partner.
Mm-hmm.
He's an artist. So I would hope it would come out over here, like January, February, you know?
Yeah.
I would hope so.
Cool. Well, maybe PBS will pick it up, or they'll at least make it available.
Yeah. Or BBC America,
maybe. BBC America, maybe?
After Bargain Hunt, hopefully.
Yeah.
That is top on their list, for sure.
Let's see. I think I... here's one more question from Jetta. Will we see the Fez returning anytime next season? Now, I know you can't give away any spoilers.
Will we see the Fez? Perhaps. What can I give you away that's interesting? Maybe not a Fez, but maybe something akin to a Fez.
What?
Oh.
What?
Yeah.
A giant...
Falls.
The Fonz?
What is it? Yeah, the Fonz.
The Fonz is gonna.
Oh man, that would be Henry Winkler.
You just blew my mind. You just blew my mind. He'd punch the TARDIS with his hand.
No, the Doctor goes to Happy Days.
Of course.
Holy crap.
Wow. Ron Howard.
Do you think Ron Howard would be on board for that? He would be on board.
He could direct. Ron, if you're listening, come and direct Doctor Who.
Please, Ron Howard, who probably doesn't listen to my show. That would be incredible.
Wow, that would
probably
be cool.
Probably doesn't listen to them. Of course he doesn't.
Ron Howard probably doesn't.
Ron Howard's busy.
Are you going to have time to... Because now I would imagine like offers are probably rolling in, but I'm sure you're pretty tied up with Doctor Who.
Literally, yeah. I mean, I've been batting Spielberg away the lot. No, they're not. it gets tiring. I say, Ron, no, I won't be...
crying on the phone. Crying.
I don't know, really. It was nice to do Christopher, which was different. And, I hope to do something interesting in my next gap, sort of in between Who series and stuff. So, of course, it does open doors, though, being the Doctor and playing a part that has that sort of profile. So it affords you opportunity. But it's not as though, you know, I've got people going, please be in my film.
But it's got profile, but it also has substance, which I think is so great. Because there are, I feel like there are high-profile roles you could get trapped into that wouldn't necessarily show off the breadth that the Doctor does.
And I'm just, I'm really fortunate. I don't wish to bang on about it, but to have Stephen, who, for my money, he's the best in England. He's the best, you know? He's the best. I just think he's unparalleled and unmatched in his inventiveness and particularly in the way that he interprets the Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Agreed.
And I do want to, because I'm sure you're going to be doing a lot of interviews here, but just in general, I want to apologize on behalf of everyone who takes the opportunity to ask you a lot of questions about Karen.
Oh, no.
Because I've worked on a show in America with an attractive girl, and then for years, just like, hey, what's going on there? I'm like, please stop asking me questions about that.
Really? Yeah. It's a but.
I mean, I don't really have one other than like, did you guys form a fast friendship or?
It was really interesting. I mean, Karen is she's a true force of nature. That woman, girl, strange praying mantis thing. But we're great friends. I find her. She's one of the few people in the universe that makes me sort of laugh out loud.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been just wonderful to see how much she's evolved. I think I mean, we both have, and we've done it together, and so that obviously creates something which is undeniable for the rest of your life. But I think we got better, actually, and I think it took us a couple of months to sort of understand each other. But now we're flying, and we have great chemistry, and it's all quite instinctive. We call it the old Smith and Gillen. It's very embarrassing. The old chat shows and stuff. We'll just get the old Smith and Gillen out, won't we? It's all very self-proclamatory. But she's genuinely very funny and takes it all. She has she doesn't take herself too seriously. She's very beautiful, doing very well. And I saw her do something in an episode which I can't talk about, but I saw her do it and I went, oh my God, you're going to be an action hero.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. She swings round with something, which I can't tell you what that thing is, but I was like, you're going to be that action hero, you know, leading
late.
It's the pause. Yeah,
she swings him around. He's a weapon.
Well, Matt, much to the dismay of the listeners, I think we are about at our time point with you. I just don't want to keep you. We're both doing the Craig Ferguson show.
I know, that's
today.
Exciting. I don't know what to expect. It's
Ferguson is...
Is he cool? He seems really cool. I've watched his stuff.
He's literally one of the best people I know.
Really?
He's been on the podcast before, and we bonded over our love of Who. And when I first started, I go on a show about once a month, and we would just talk about Doctor Who.
Really?
And then it just became this thing that we had. So, he called, and he was like, you know who's going to be on the show on Tuesday? And I'm like, I think I know.
Yeah,
and then so he asked if I wanted to come on. And so
it's cool. Yeah, it's exciting. I mean, it's just great for kind of Doctor Who, really. It's good. It's, you know, it's cool that we're filming out here. But so, I mean, you guys like the new carnation of Who, do you?
I love it. What's so interesting about it, and sort of what I touched on earlier, is that you did exactly, I think, what was supposed to happen, which is you just did your own. You did your take on it.
It was so weird because I was such a Tennant fan, and I was like, wow. Yeah.
No, he's a brilliant doctor, though. David's so great.
And as soon as I saw you, I was like, all right, I can do. And then I was like, oh, I get it. Oh, this is very good.
My friend Scott Addison and I were talking about it, right after the first or second episode, and he said the thing that is so great about Matt is that even though, like, on the outside he looks like a young dude, he plays the character like he is 900 years old. Like, you can feel the depth and the age him.
That's a lovely observation, because that's, I think, probably consciously something I aimed for.
There's always something, when I'm watching you as Doctor Who, there's always, you feel like there's always something you're thinking, like, there's always something else in your head.
Yeah,
like this the weight of the universe.
I hope so.
And it's just like,
I don't know how you, like, the dichotomy of you're able to play a character that is a boyish old man, which is incredible.
But only the Doctor can be that.
Only
right?
the Doctor,
and it's so, that's why James Bond, no way, Doctor Who.
Well, your performance sort of is a microcosm of the show on the whole, which is that balance of light and dark, which is so hard to find and to get to. It has the gravity that it needs to have for the kind of legacy of it and all the stories, and as you said, all the blood on their hand on the various doctors' hands, but it also is something that you could watch with your kids that is fun and energetic and sweeping musical scores and action and bright and humor, and that's hard to do.
Maybe we've cried once or twice during the maybe
I would just like to add to the producers of James Bond, I'm sorry for being dismissive. Please consider me for any upcoming villains.
I think you could be a Bond.
I don't know. I mean, maybe a villain, though. Bond villain would be fun.
I think seeing...
If MGM ever gets their shit together.
I know, if they ever do.
Gets out of another.
Yeah, you would be an amazing Bond villain. But there's no question in my mind that you're going to have a wonderful career as an actor. Even beyond Who. And thank you so much for keeping the show fun and interesting. And I know, you know, like, people... Because, how nerds get about certain things that they get used to, and I expected, like, oh, there might be, for this poor guy, there might be a lot of Tennant backlash, and I saw none. It was, like, everyone just uniformly was like, this guy is great, like, right from the get-go.
I mean, of course, you know, and, I mean, rightly so, everyone became very attached to Dave playing the role, because he was a brilliant doctor, but I think it's one of the great virtues of that particular part that it can change, and you know, it's good that, I don't know. I mean, as I say, people on the whole have been very positive and kind, and of course, but you know, I don't go on the internet.
No, because there's always going to be some guy who's like, John Pertwee is the only doctor. Yeah. And you're like, God, why did I have to see that?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Right? Hey, there we are. But thanks for having me on the podcast.
Matt Smith, it was an extreme pleasure.
I'll see you tonight.
I will see you tonight on the Craig Ferguson show. Yeah, we will have fun. I hear
we're
he has
shaking
a
hands.
Thank you. Thank you.
We're all
shaking hands.
Shaking hands.
There we are.
Matt Smith, that is the end of the podcast.
And you did not eat all the cookies.
Oh, I know, but I have been thinking about them for like the past 10 minutes,
oh,
actually seeing that one there annoying.
You said you always thought there was something else going on in his head, and now you know exactly. It's cookies. Yeah.
It's cookies.
Yep.
Enjoy your burrito, America.
Woo! Now leaving Nerdist.com.